I'm your host, Rena Friedman Watts, and this is the Better Call Daddy Show.
Hey, this is Big Daddy, Wayne Friedman.
That's my grandpa. Grandpa, you ready for more daddy drama?
My dad is my number one hero and number one fan.
And I'm a pretty cool dude.
All right, season four, baby, here we go.
More stories you're not going to believe.
And maybe you will after you listen.
5 stars.
5.5 stars, 2 thumbs up.
You are a pretty cool dude.
Love you, Mommy.
Don't stand on the table and damn the public. You'll get some words of wisdom to live by.
Here we go again. Better call daddy.
You know what your problem is? You like me.
Yeah, I do. Each week, I interview a guest, share the stories with my dad, and then he weighs in at the end of every episode with his wisdom and wit.
Hey, Grandpa.
Everyone from influential players to inspirational fathers, and of course, controversial people.
Grandpa, my mom is calling.
Creating that legacy one call at a time. And welcome to the Better Call Daddy Show.
Stay tuned.
Where's the music?
Better call daddy, cause he knows you're bad. He's bringing the test. He sees possibilities. Possibilities. Ooh, better call daddy, he'll be by your side. Better call daddy, you're the apple of his eye. He sees possibilities. Oh,
today's interview is a rebroadcast of Benoit Kim interviewing me on the Discover More podcast. Putting yourself out there and surrounding yourself by the right people gives you a better chance for success. My dad said that Benoit Kim has an A game.
Rena, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I loved that animation and enthusiasm. Let's bring it home.
You always told me that you love daddy issues. Whenever I introduce some guest to you who have gone through or currently undergoing daddy issues, right? Aside from being really funny, can you elaborate what that means to you?
So I have a really close relationship with my dad, and I have found that other people are interested in how we have that relationship. And so people have asked to adopt my dad. People have called my dad. Other daddy's girls have found me. And when I initially launched the Better Call Daddy show, I really didn't realize that that was going to be the pull. I thought that my casting background and presenting shock and awe types of stories is what was going to bring people my way. But I had podcasters with comedic podcasts who have never shared their daddy story reach out. I had CEOs of companies who said that they had a hard time living up to their father's success. There are so many daddy issues and so many subjects around being a father. I felt like that was missing in the marketplace. And then I felt like the relationship with me and my dad couldn't be replicated. So that brought a uniqueness factor to the show I wanted to create.
The dynamic between you and your dad is extremely unique because even in your introduction for your podcast, there's a banter. You two roast each other openly in the show and outside of the show, right? And I don't believe in coincidence. I think everything happens the way it does. And I'm currently going through therapy myself because of my deeply repressed emotions, a lot of the anger I harbor, and the abandonment issues from my biological father since I've been with my stepdad for about 16 years. But him and I are currently not on speaking terms because of some family issues we're going through. All that to say, I lacked a father or men role model growing up. And I think that's extremely pervasive now that a lot of young men don't have good role models. And that's why people like Andrew Tate are becoming this shining role model that people look up to, like fifth graders. And it is extremely concerning, right? But I feel like that's a really important way to start today's episode because the dynamic that you have in the relationship and the closeness you and your dad exemplify on the show and off the show in your stories, like on Instagram and social media, it brings me endless joy day to day.
Aw, thank you so much for saying that. I feel like when my dad wraps up the episode and he genuinely listens to the episode alone and he has his own experience and take from the interview that I have with the guest. And I feel like what he says to the guest is almost like a present at the end. He gives them encouragement. He makes a place for them. He connects with them on Facebook. He cares about their story. And I know something that you've said even in your own episodes is people don't even necessarily want advice. They just want to be seen and heard and listened to and almost validated. And I feel like my dad is so good at validation and care and enthusiasm. And that's enough. Just giving each one of the guests who's vulnerable enough to share with him, that at the end is the magic piece.
His ability to hold the space and his ability to provide like succinct summary in like two sentences. How does he does it? Like, how does he do that so naturally?
He gets a lot of practice with me because I call him every single day with so many different situations. I will say that the podcast, I feel like, has given me even more special daddy time, which my sisters are a little bit jealous of, but it's helped him learn the experts that are coming on our show. And then just even everyday people, the more stories that you hear in different ways, even if they have the same themes, there's something that you can take from every single story. I think it's honestly helped him in his own life. My dad has never been one to make a lot of friends. He worked, he cared about his family. He has taken care of both of his parents. He goes to synagogue. He doesn't need fame. He's a character. He's always beat to his own drum, but he's not doing it for the likes. He is doing it to try to make an impact one person at a time. And I think people feel that.
And that spills over also to your family, right? Where I think we can relate, whereas most of us get really busy. A lot of us has a lot of ambitions, different gravitational pulls in life, different obligations. And even staying in touch with your good friends in life is hard. I have so many best friends in LA and I see them once every 3 months. And we're actively trying. And I feel like you have this natural way of keeping this closeness, connections, and kindling with your dad very frequently. And it requires both way effort. Because just because we were gifted with this relationship that we call family, their birthright and blood, that still means you have to cultivate it intentionally. Especially as you get older and the currents of life gets heavier and heavier, and we get swept underneath quite often.
Alongside that, I have to say that since we do this together so often, I have to remember to ask my dad, like, how's your day versus ready to do another reaction?
Yeah.
How is your mom doing? How are you doing? What is mom making you do today? Just simple questions like that. I have to remember to care back because he's so good at caring.
Effort is always bidirectional, I believe. And I feel like that segues naturally into the next question, which is your self-proclaimed identity as a story junkie. I never heard that until you brought it up, so I've been stealing it since. Because I think the essence of podcaster is networkers. We are the masters of networking. And also, we love collecting different stories. Ergo, story junkies that you talked about, right? So, like, what about people's stories that inspired you to become this Erico story junkie and led you to a series of life from the Jerry Springer Show, legal drama, court TV, and every other dating or reality TVs you've been part of? And storytelling is always a root and the through line. But what about people's stories that call you out so much?
I think I love marketing too. And so I'm constantly testing how to say things better. And when you find a good story, it's not just finding a good story, but it's what is going to capture the audience's attention. What's that first hook? What's that first line? I worked in casting. So that is where I got my feet wet in storytelling. One of my best stories was someone who didn't even say her name. She left a message saying, I'm 14 years old and I caught my grandmother in bed with my boyfriend. That gets your attention. That got me promoted. That story went an entire show, multiple segments. So what is the line? What is the story that is going to stop people in their tracks? And how can I find common ground with that person? How can I get that person to open up to me and trust me and relate to me? That is what gets me going.
So how do you balance this professional hazard? Like in real life, when I come across people that's fascinating, my brain goes, ooh, podcast, podcast, podcast. So how do you dance this dance where you view humans as wholesomely they are and also be cognizant of the fact that, ooh, they might have some fascinating, important story to share? Because often it's not ours to keep, but ours to share.
Oh, that's a hard question. I think, yeah, you have to take a step back and not make it about, ooh, they'd make a great podcast, and make it about the other person first. That's actually a key to connecting. It's never about you first. It's, I'm impressed by your work. I'd love to learn more. I am blown away by your ideas on YouTube. Or it's finding the common ground, but complimenting the other person first. Engaging with the other person first in multiple ways before you let them know there's something I want from you.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious because you and I were both ferocious podcast consumers, right? That's why we became a producer or the podcasters after the fact. When I tune into a certain podcast, like new ones I come across, within, I would say 10 to 15 minutes, since I listen to long form podcasts only, I can tell whether the host is having the guest on so they can hear more of their own voices and what they have to speak versus if they're genuinely and authentically interested and curious about what the guest has to offer. Can you tell that?
Ooh, that is such a good point. Now I'm going to listen more carefully. I also want to say, can you tell whether the host reached out to the guest or the guest reached out to the host? Who's more interested in being on?
Yeah, I view a lot of things in power dynamics because that's what that is, right? Even me as a psychotherapist, in my offices, I have to always be cognizant of the fact that there's this invisible power dynamics at play, always. And sometimes you can strategically lean into the authoritative role by asking them to be more accountable, ask them to complete the in-between sessions, like task, because therapy is just part of the work, but the work happens in integration, as I talk about in the show a lot. But it's a very dangerous fine line because a lot of psychotherapists, physicians, helpers get disqualified and dislicensed from flexing or leaning in too much of their power dynamics. And at the end of the day, we're both humans, you know, but I'm going to also take that cue and listen in to see if I can tell the difference between not desperate per se, but who's more eager, because, you know, it does show here and there.
Oh, yes, it does. Have you seen that in your policy work as well?
100%. So I left my, I could tell you've done deep research for the for my background, but long story short, the catalyst for me to leave and depart from my policymaking journey is because I witnessed my CEO and my nonprofit policy, like actually narcissistic as a person. And at the same time, he's this utilitarian impact maker. He believes that the end, which is the impact, will justify the means. But when he's in the meetings, when he's talking to, because he was also an advisor to the city of, or the mayor of Philadelphia for 20 years, he's extremely in high power position. But even when he talks about himself and every meeting that I've been part of, because I was a program manager there, 85% of the meetings about him talking about himself. And so, yes, he definitely uses that power dynamics to his leverage when he doesn't really have to. But it's very common for politicians, policymakers, because that power, right? They say absolute power corrupts people absolutely. And I think he's a good example of that, in addition to his narcissistic personality to begin with.
Hey, I hope we encourage other people to analyze interviews and politicians a little bit more.
Speaking of putting on the mask and not all stories about shocks and awes, in your one of your featured interviews that I did preparation for today's interview, you talked about a lot of TV and media is about putting lipstick on a pig. What is the reality behind so-called many reality TV shows for the, you know, general public who doesn't really have that opportunity to unveil the curtain, so to speak? Because you have over two decades of extensive experiences in media and TV and everything in between.
I've even interviewed some of the stars from the reality shows that I've worked on. And their first time experiences in Hollywood or even multiple experiences in Hollywood isn't what they thought it would be. And sometimes that can be disheartening. And you and I were talking even before this, some reality stars, they get all of this fame, and then when it goes away, they don't know who they are anymore. So Hollywood can be a destructive force. I will say that it needs to be suspenseful. It needs to evoke emotions. Certain things need to happen in order for people to tune in. So it's edited. Are there elements of truth? Yes. Do they overshoot things in order to capture storylines that they're looking for? Absolutely. If you video people long enough, things are going to happen naturally. That's why when I worked in TV, there was around the clock cameras other than in the bathrooms. It's life. And some of it just magically occurs where you can't even script it. And that's the best magic, right? You can have a good story on paper and then they could see the crowd and totally suck too. You know, somebody can be amazing on the phone and they can tell you their story and they can be high energy and then they see the room and the lights and the camera and they freeze. Or somebody can tell you their story and it can take a totally different path than you imagined and they can become a 10 guest and you didn't even see it coming. There's so much nuance in that question. I've seen where they needed to create drama. So like a husband walks off set and it was a work call and they made it look like a fight between the husband and the wife, right? Were there fights between the husband and the wife? Probably, but they needed one in the cut. So sometimes there's that. Also, the kids in like the nanny show, right? Like they may stuff things down the drain and cause a plumbing error, but we also might need that to happen. So we might encourage things. Same thing on the Jerry Springer show, right? Like, do these guests want a piece of each other? Absolutely. Do we encourage them to want a piece of each other? Absolutely.
Yeah, it's such a fine line because when that magic happens that you just talked about, that also translates to podcasting. If you're seasoned and experienced enough, if you're in this immersive state, like a flow state with the guest virtually and in person, because flow state happens virtually too, if you're really immersed. And it's even more magical when you know that, oh shit, the listeners will also experience and feel that magical moment, even as a third party. And when everything aligns, it's such a gratifying feeling. But to your point, magic doesn't happen and you can't really manufacture magic all the time. That's what magic means. It happens outside of your control because flow state requires the ingredients of surrender. And without surrender, flow state doesn't happen. It's been documented scientifically. You have to have a certain level of discomfort, which is a scaffolding of challenges, right? You have to feel a little bit nervous. And with that little bit of nerve-wracking feeling, with the confidence, the preparations, and surrender, that's when flow state happens. And I think that's the same thing for podcasting and interviews and conversations as well.
I was just talking to my husband about that before I ran on the treadmill before this call, is that how many podcasts do you need to listen to of someone to prepare for an interview? When I first started podcasting, I did very little preparation, but now I feel like I want to know that person better. I want to go deeper into conversation, but can you over-prepare? You can only stalk the person's social media so much, especially if you're doing a lot of interviews. How much stalking is the right amount of stalking? How many people do you need to connect to in that person's inner circle? Is one or two good? Do you want to leave room for magic? Do you want to leave room for spontaneity? Do you want to know everything about the person? You have to leave room for curiosity and magic in life and in interviewing and podcasting.
The title of this episode will be Optimal Amount of Stalking by Rena Freeman Watts. I definitely think you can't over-prepare because like even when I was preparing for you and all the other guests, and it's not really a preset time, but I just intuitive know, oh, this is a good place to stop preparing because that's when my organic curiosity gets tainted. And some of the questions I want to ask is derived out of the question that's been asked before. So that's when I know, oh, okay, I think I've done enough preparation for now. And it's such interesting where you have to have the due diligence because due diligence is everything in life. At the same time, you have to leave room, because when you create space, something happens, but you have to create space. It's very meta, but that's the philosophy I uphold in life.
Oh, look, I actually wrapped up with a couple of clients recently, and I was a little disappointed about it. But when I started with them, knew that it could potentially be project-based or short-term. But a little piece of me is like, I kind of wish that would have gone longer, or I kind of wish I would have mapped out my expectations better or found out their expectations better. Like, I always want things to be magnificent. And we did some good work together. And I think he wanted somebody full time, and I didn't really want to work in that capacity. So, but then I was thinking to myself, I've just started with this radio station. I have a little bit of a learning curve there because I haven't worked in radio since college, and I want to do a really good job at it. And what would happen if I actually took less clients and focused on me a little bit more, right? Like exercising 4 days a week, eating healthier, sleeping 8 hours a day, being more helpful to my children who also deserve mommy, being a better wife, making a couple more phone calls to grandma. You have to make space for what's important to you and for healthy habits. So things weren't, at least they didn't end badly with the client. We just decided he needs a full-time person and I can't be that. So it was great while it lasted, and on to something better and making space for something better and for something that fits within the time that I have free.
I love podcasting so much that even if you pay me a stupid amount of money, I will not stop, because I'm almost near 4 years. I share that because I've realized this on year one of podcasting, where the quality of my podcast episodes is predicated on the quality of my life. If I have adventures in life, if I keep reading books, if I have meaningful connections, if I have great conversations offline, that translates directly to the conversation and the quality of the episodes I produce with the guest. So I feel like you shifting that focus into the self is actually going to level up your radio presence through Kuul.fm and also your podcast. And it's so counterintuitive, but sometimes by doing less, you achieve more.
Yes, yes, yes. And you and Patrick talked a little bit about that too.
Yeah, and we're terrified of idleness. Like, the word idleness is probably like the most terrifying evil word in capitalistic America. Like, idleness? What? You're doing nothing? Like, well, what are you going to achieve in life? Well, life's a season, right?
What are you going to achieve in life? Balance, health, confidence, better questions.
Yeah.
Just one more thing alongside that is, like, I spent so many years of my life measuring success by money. I know a lot of people talk about that, but that is such a double-edged sword. And I don't anymore measure success on money. And I think the pandemic really taught me that. I believe truthfully that money is kind of predestined. And, you know, you can work really hard for it, and then you can have a health scare and all your money can go to the hospital. So,
yep. No, it's you can pre-plan everything meticulously, but that one car accident that happened to me a while ago that could just derail everything. You're like, oh wow, I thought I had a pulse on life. Nope. Yeah, life is a trip. So surrender is the way, right? So I want to ask you about curiosity, which is a through line between everything we just talked about. And I think your success as a mompreneur, mom who's an entrepreneur, why do you think that curiosity, Rena, is a non-negotiable as an entrepreneur who pivoted multiple times throughout your media and business career? Because now you have a media agency, you do production work, right? You also have 14 different things you wear.
Not only is curiosity important for entrepreneurship, but we even talked about how it's important for interviewing and podcasting. If you don't have an interest and you're not value aligned in the work, then you're just doing it for money.
Do you feel like curiosity allowed you to be okay with the unknown?
Yes, I do feel like it helps me be okay with the unknown. Here's an example of a client that I just recently took was, she's a multiple best-selling author and she's busy. And I think that sometimes marketing yourself is harder than having someone else market you. And so she reached out to me and said, hey, I've already gotten one testimonial for my upcoming book, but I feel like you would be better at reaching out to someone else who I'd like for a testimonial. Would you be interested in that? And I am interested in true crime and forensics, like you mentioned. And I have multiple shared connections with the person who she wanted for the testimonial. And I'm interested in the work that that person does. And they have a large YouTube following. So yeah, can I guarantee her a result? No. Am I pretty sure, since we have over 150 shared connections, that I can reach the person? Yes. Is it a risk? Yeah. Can I probably reach that person easier than her? Yeah. Did I get paid up front and tell her no guarantees? Yeah. That's entrepreneurship. That's curiosity. But it's also, you know, all of my experience combined into one and a new challenge.
That comes down to managing expectations, right? So I think a lot of times we struggle to manage our own expectations. So professionally, how do you massage and help manage your clients, their expectations, since you get paid up front?
Oh, I had to get better at that, because one thing that I saw my dad and his parents, they ran a manufacturing company for 40 plus years, and a lot of their business was on handshakes and trust. And there was a lot of family-run businesses in my dad's day. And today, I mean, I'm sorry, but you can't just trust people. Yeah. I've been burned one too many times by people who tell you they have your back, or people who say we're friends and we're doing business. No. Once somebody's paid you, or once somebody wants to engage with you in business, you're no longer friends. I'm sorry. You know, you can like your clients and you can share personal information with them if that's how you operate in business. But if you're going to do business together, it's business. And I don't want to be chasing money. That is my least favorite thing to do in entrepreneurship. So if you want my time and you want my expertise, it's limited. You got to pay for it.
Yeah, that hits a sore spot, because I just departed with my working relationship with my audio engineer, who produced my new music intro and who also designed my current graph. I've known him for 5 years as friends. But, you know, I don't want to share the gory details, but navigating that complexity and multi-layer relationship is really, really tough, especially he's still in Philadelphia. I'm in LA. Yeah, I relate, because I struggle with that grief, because people only view grief as loss of a life. But one of the highest and most intensive form of grief is losing friendship. Like, let's say you've been in friends with someone for years and something happens, and the relationship and friendship comes to an abrupt end. How do you deal with this emptiness and this longing? And that's grief. So I'm still moving through that right now. But yeah, I think that's an important point, because sometimes you can't have it all and you have to make priorities and trade-offs based on the circumstances that you're currently in.
I'm sorry you're going through that. And I would have a hard time with that too. 5 years is a really long time. And sometimes we, in order to up-level or in order to improve, unfortunately, we have to make those hard choices. I can really sympathize. I've been with my editor for 3 years, and I've questioned whether I need to find somebody else too. She's been with me since day one. And we've had some back and forth moments where I thought I was definitely going to move on. Yeah. And I called my dad and I said, how do I diplomatically respond? People go through stuff too. Like, you know, she's lost family members during our relationship together. I've, you know, gone through a miscarriage. She's gone through a miscarriage, death and miscarriage. And I was going to say simchas, which is a Hebrew word, but, you know, big events and so many ups and downs in life. And to be honest, sometimes it's just time. The project ends, the friendship ends, and good for you for taking the time to grieve. I have had to part from relationships that no longer served me. And it kept me up at night, and it eventually gets better.
A good friend, he's a mentor, we're still staying in touch. He told me that when you're going through this rapid process of leveling up, however you define that as, you have to mentally prepare for the reality that whoever's been with you and next to you won't be there 3 years from now. And that iteration happens every 3 years based on the pace of leveling up you're going through. Anything comes up for you there?
I've seen it in my own dad's work. My dad has managed hundreds of people. Who's around now? Very few. Even in creating a podcast, right? It's about the journey. It's about the process. When you listen back to what you sounded like and, you know, you've been doing this, you said, for 4 years. Oh my gosh. Even today, I feel like I leveled up for this conversation, right? You were like, Rena, I have a big YouTube presence. You need to make sure your lighting's good, your sound's good. We checked the levels. We talked about, is the static going to be okay? In the beginning, you didn't think about any of that. In the beginning, I had guests walking around on their cell phones, walking around, not even sitting. I had best friends from college who used a zillion filler words. I did zero research. It's a constant up-leveling and evaluating and introspection and getting feedback and getting mentored and thinking more intentionally about what you're doing. Just like you and I were talking about, who are your friends that have stayed with you from college and seen you through many chapters? Who are the people that can put up with you on a bad day, on a good day, when you want to level up? How are they leveling up? That's a good question. If you're getting the same output every single time and they're not coming up with new freaking ideas, that is a sign that you might need somebody who can come up with some new ideas.
Yeah, I'm terrified to becoming that friend from high school. So wears their varsity Letterman jacket at age 30 and still talking about the good old glorious high school days. I was like, holy crap, man. Sure, there is a place to cherish these pure, untainted moments, because when you're in high school or college, everyone's broke. So there is no transactional nature, right? So it's very pure. At the same time, if you're in your 30s and 40s, should you, and I hate the word should you be reminiscing about the high school days while wearing that Letterman jacket? I don't know. Something is, I think I hate to be stuck in a certain memory lane. I'd rather create new memories through intentionality.
I'm going to give you a little pushback on that, okay? Because I actually just had a conversation with my husband about that too, because we moved back to Houston recently, which was his hometown. He hasn't lived here in 27 years, and he is literally going through memory lane. I mean, he took me to this club where he used to hang out in the 80s, and we are the old people in the club now. I'm like, oh my God, would I hang out with any of these people in real life? Do any of these people have jobs? Like, they all are wearing wings and have like dyed crazy color hair, and they look in their mid-40s. And what he said to me was, in Judaism, every single year, we celebrate the same holidays. Every year, we try to go a little bit deeper into those holidays and tell the stories a little bit differently so that we can expand upon these traditions. So we're constantly actually living in the past and repeating the cycles of the Bible every year. So maybe if that guy that's wearing the jacket, the letter jacket, is stuck in the past, he needs to just wear the letter jacket, rock it with his, you know, beat to his own drum attitude, and take on a new skill that enhances that look.
Yeah, true. I mean, well received. At the same time, to be fair, you and your husband are leveling up present tense, reminiscing about the past. So you're driving down the memory lane with a different vehicle, right? So there's some nuances there for sure.
But I think too, I mean, a part of me, I wanted to interview Jerry Springer. I haven't worked for the guy for over 20 years, but I also wanted to thank him for starting my career and so many other people's careers and find out after all of these years, what was it like on his side of the production? Did he really understand all of what we went through to make that show happen? I had been dying to know that for 20 years. Like, I always wanted to know that. And I've followed his path. I've watched him speak at universities and commencement speeches and different organizations that I'm not a part of, but respect. he's done a podcast. He's been on Dancing with the Stars. He had an opera done after him. The guy's done everything. And I was just like, man, what was that like on your side? But I was living in the past. I was living in the past, right? Like, that was 20 years ago, Rena. But he appreciated my admiration from afar and that I had been following his journey that long. He actually was super humble and really human in our conversation. It felt like a God moment for me, honestly, interviewing him. I felt like God fulfilled that for me. It was something that I needed on a spiritual level.
I know one of the most affirmative and divine God moments you experience is having the man who started your career back in the show 20 years later, which is a pretty crazy synchronistic full circle of life that not many have the opportunity to experience and witness. So what was that affirmative moment like, having this air quote equal grounding, because he's on your show this time, whereas in the beginning you were working for his show? What was that moment like, and anything that comes up for you right now?
Oh God, I was first of all so nervous, and my kids had messed with my Zoom settings, and I was like uninstalling and reinstalling Zoom right before the interview. Then he calls me from like his personal cell phone number. He didn't even block the number. I was like, hey, I'm getting ready to hop on. Are you good? I'm like, I'm good. I'm freaking out, totally freaking out. I've done all this preparation and I want to be cool and like ready 10 minutes before and looking good. And I'm panicking that the video is screwed up and I'm using Zoom at the time. The video only recorded him. It did not record any of me. And then I'm like, what is that on a spiritual level? At least I got Jerry and I was able to like cut up some of those clips. But more than the video, it was truly about that full circle moment for me. It was validating. It felt like closure. It felt like unanswered questions that I had for all of these years. And I was only supposed to get 20 minutes with the guy. He went an hour. He was so generous with his time. I feel like for so much of my life, I put celebrities up on this pedestal, especially him. I met him in my early 20s. I was 21 years old being a producer on that show. And even though I was backstage with the guy from week to week and sitting next to him, I was fangirling and nervous around him and not myself ever the whole time on the show. I was putting him on this pedestal. And 20 years later, he was like, oh my God, you worked for me when you were a kid. I remember you when you were a baby. You know, you're all grown up now. He was so human and so complimentary. And he even got the theme of my show. He had a question for my dad and he told me, you know, your idea is great. It can't be replicated. The relationship that you have with your dad is unique. Lean into that. So that was really validating too.
That's awesome, where like the secret sauce that holds your puzzle and your show together is recognized by the man started your career.
Oh, I love that you said that. And yes, that's exactly it.
So let's go down to this affirmative moments by the cosmos that we call God a little bit deeper, where you probably came across this. This is one of my favorite segments to ask on the show, where every single person I've had on the show, that's like 85 plus at this point, they've all had some sort of affirmative moments by God and the cosmos during some of their lowest moments in life. But then the God was like, Rena, stay the course, keep going. Do you have any other moments that came up besides the full circle moments with Jerry? Any moments that held you to this path? Because entrepreneurship, being a mom, being a good human, and also being a podcaster of a top 1% show comes with a lot of mental gymnastics and just
I'll tell you, my belief in God stems from having a good dad in this world. There were many years where I didn't even believe in God. I for sure tried to test him. I'm like, okay, there's a God if I make this basket. Okay, best 2 out of 3. That was me as a kid. What came up for me when you were describing the question was I got seriously screwed over by someone in business. And I had been working for this person for like 7 months. I left a financial firm to work for this guy And he said he was going to make me a partner. He made me business cards. He flew me out to Orange County. I was pregnant. I didn't even tell him. I put on this event. He was taking me into multi-million dollar, you know, business owners' homes. And he ended up cutting me completely out of a deal. Like, he closed on a very large life insurance policy that I brought the lender for. I organized the event around. I met with. He wasn't even there. And I will never forget this moment. I called the lender and he told me, you know, that business deal closed, right? I had just pumped breast milk. I dropped the breast milk all over the floor. I was shook. I was shaking. I had no idea that they closed that behind my back. And not only did the lender stab me in the back, you know, the CPA stabbed me in the back, all of these people that stood next to me that said, you're the bridge here. You're people that I trusted. That was one of my hardest lessons in life. And I'm still, I have a hard time with that in even taking new clients, because it is a bit of trust in everybody that you do business with. That's why, and I learned this from someone who I'm paying right now to give my son chess lessons. He will not give my son a chess lesson unless he gets paid first. Even if I've previously paid him, he won't even talk to me unless the money's in the bank first. You know, he's got better things to do, right? He's in 80 schools across the nation and he's newly married and he'd rather do a date night. If the money is not in the bank, he's not even going to chat me back. And I'm like, as abrasive as that may seem, good for him. You know, I learned from that. Business is business, right? So that was the biggest burn I've ever experienced, because I ended up having a miscarriage after flying my in-laws out to take care of my kids and go put on an event and go into all of these very expensive homes and present to these people privately. I remember too, my oldest son, I think, said to me, all of the money in the world can't replace the baby that you then had after. I'll just never forget that. So I feel fortunate that I was able to then have a healthy baby. And that's another thing too about doing business, is that you really, just like you stalk people online to be on your podcast and who you're going to align yourself with and what they say, and you do all of this research into who you're showcasing, you need to do that in business as well. And I think sometimes we forget that, because these opportunities come so quickly your way that you don't do enough research into who their customers are, how they're treating their customers, how are they doing business. And to be honest, there was red flags with this guy. I left the firm that I was at because he screwed over my boss. And he also had all of these certificates on his wall on how not to commit fraud, yet the guy was totally a fraudster. So I learned to do better research. I learned to listen to my gut more, because my gut told me that he was going to screw me over too. And my dad too encouraged me to go on that trip, because he thought, if you just close one, it's worth it. And now too, I was like, Dad, you weren't right about that one. I totally should have listened to my gut. And he was like, I think you're right.
Yeah, thanks for sharing about the miscarriage, because I know that's one of the highest form of pain, emotionally, physically, mentally, that a woman, and not just women, that a married couple can experience together. But of course, it's more visceral for you, literally biologically. So yeah, thanks for sharing. And once again, every time you and I, we talk offline and online, the synchronistic nature is crazy, because I just had this conversation this morning at the gym with the gym friends. He is in his late 60s, but like the 5 a.m. crew is very tight in the morning. And we were talking about how whoever calls themselves humble are not humble. Just like the guy with wall of certificates saying that, oh, anti-fragilant, people who overcompensate is probably the projections of what they lack internally. So it's very timely with the discussions I had in the gym. And yeah, I want to take that actually into this question that just came up from what you just shared. A lot of people, I think, in 2023 have this over-fixations on, oh, wasted time. Oh, what if I make the wrong decisions and make the wrong move in life? I'm going to waste my time. I don't agree with that, because I've pivoted my career 3 times, as you know, in 7 years. And every single thing I've taken away from my previous career, because I'm not talking about job transitions, I'm talking about career transitions, there's always one or two skill set that I cultivated, I continue to exercise and apply in my current profession. Whether it's from policy to psychotherapy or from management consulting, you probably didn't know about because it's not my resume. I left the rat race 6 months after graduation. But I always took away something. How do you view this idea that there is no such thing as wasted opportunity as long as you're being intentional with this transferable skill set mindset?
I often talk about transferable skills, and I often talk about the fact that I have pivoted and tried so many things in my career. That's really true. I went from being a producer in Chicago in NBC Tower, making $80,000 a year my first year out of college, to trying a sales role that I was very unfit for. I thought if I could talk people into doing crazy things on national television, of course I could sell them a sporting event package to these gatekeeper CEOs. Well, I had to go through the gatekeeper to get to the CEO and try to get them to go to these sporting event packages. It was brutal. It was such a chop shop. It sucked. I hated it. I literally told them I was going out for a smoke break and never came back. And then I moved to LA. I was like, okay, that wasn't for me, but I was willing to try it. It was in the same building. I had schmoozed people in NBC. I found out about the job. I think you have to be willing to try things, but also be willing to quit things quickly that aren't a good fit. So I moved to LA, and I don't even think, I mean, my husband tells me this. He's like, you take so many opportunities that I wouldn't even entertain, right? Like, he has specific companies that he wouldn't work for. He has specific verticals that he wouldn't work for. I've worked in financial services. I've worked in telecom. I've worked in the entrepreneurial space. I'm like, marketing is marketing. If I like the people and how they do business and I find interest in the work that they're doing, I can market them. So I went from being a producer on a nationally syndicated show to starting all over as an executive assistant to three very seasoned producers, because I was like, hey, these guys have worked in Hollywood for three generations. They have a lot of connections. They're working on a different side of the industry. I'm going to learn something. Do I want to be there forever? No, but it's that whole tour of duty thing. Work there till you network enough, learn something, and find another opportunity. And I worked for the Kyoto Brothers. They were the first people who hired me in LA. It was a special effects animation company in Burbank. These guys, it was a family-run business, which is also great because then they're willing to let you wear a lot of different hats and kind of peek behind the curtain. That's who you want to work for. You don't want to work for the studio where there's so many like people having to position themselves, and that's not the way to go, and they don't pay well. So I worked for the Kyoto Brothers. I got the opportunity to see them pitch Disney and Paramount and work on a South Park feature and all of these things, and see the accounts payable and receivable behind that and how they location scout and all of these things that I definitely didn't learn at Springer. And then from there, I was applying to gigs on the side to get back into production. Everybody wants the production gigs, but those opportunities are a lot harder to get. So you need something stable that's going to pay the rent. And then when you get enough experience, you can jump back to what you really want to be doing, but get some legs first.
Yeah, the idea of get your boots wet or boots on the ground, it works, but there's nuances and layers to that too, right? It's not just, oh yeah, get your feet wet, just go out there. It's like, hold on, there's like six levels before that step.
That's the first part of my discussion with Benoit Kim on his podcast, Discover More. We'll have part two next week at the same time, 10 p.m. Eastern, here on Kool.fm.
Thanks for listening to the Better Call Daddy Show.
Now you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts,
Google Play,
Spotify,
iHeartRadio,
and TuneIn.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Better Call Daddy Show, please feel free to review it
at ratethispodcast.com/BetterCallDaddy. Add Better Call Daddy Podcast on IG at Rena Friedman Watts on LinkedIn.com.